If you've ever listened to this show before, you might be thinking, this doesn't sound like Mark. And you'd be right. It sounds like Chris, because that's me. My name is Chris. After countless great years working together, our good friend Mark Summers has moved on to new adventures at Alberta Innovates. From the whole team at ERA, we wish him the best and are genuinely excited to follow all the important work he's going to get up to over there. My name is Chris Outram, and I'm stepping into Mark's big shoes as Executive Director, Technology and Innovation with ERA. You'll be hearing from me and some of our other amazing team members at ERA on future episodes of Carbon Copy. Now, I want to take us on a little journey to the center of the Earth. Pick any spot on Earth, it doesn't really matter where, and start traveling straight down. After you've worked your way past the crust and the mantle, and after you've gone deeper than anyone has ever really dug before, you're going to hit the core. Down there, the pressure is so great that the hard crust and mantle give away to this hot, swirling ball of mostly iron and nickel. Almost as important as the sun shining above our heads, this massive heat source is a huge part of what makes life on Earth tick, steadily radiating heat and energy back up through the layers to us on the surface. Heat and energy are pretty important, I think you'll agree. And finding sustainable sources of heat and energy is really important. But digging exceptionally deep holes to find and unleash the geothermal energy trapped down below it, well, that's not cheap. Unless you could make a deal, find someone who's already dug a really deep hole and hitch a ride, so to speak. Which is where Futura Power comes in. Futura Power is developing geothermal and natural gas hybrid power projects right here in Alberta, a place where countless projects are already digging deep underground and where we know a lot about exactly what's underneath our feet. With the right partner, these sites can potentially unleash gigawatts of sustainable energy and reduce emissions without any new footprint on the land. For this episode, I wanted to know more about what Futura Power is trying to do to change how we think about geothermal energy. So we sat down with Lisa Mueller, President and CEO of Futura Power, to discuss. Creating geothermal projects with no new footprint, the fine art of collaboration and co-production, and using legacy infrastructure as an energy transition project. Here on Carbon Copy. All right, Lisa, so I think what we'll start with is I'll just welcome you and I'll get you to just state your name, the organization you represent, and your role in the organization. So thank you for joining us on Carbon Copy. Can you please tell us who you are and who you represent and what your role is?
Good morning, Chris. Thank you for having me on this podcast. My name is Lisa Mueller. I represent Futura Power Corporation, and my role is president and CEO.
Great. Well, we're really happy to have you with us. Now, we'll start right into our questions with a broad overview of the technology that we're speaking about today. So how do you explain your technology to people that are unfamiliar with your company?
Well, first I have to explain that geothermal energy is earth heat and that it's a fully renewable resource and that the heat comes from magma. So it's deep in the earth. It's always there. If you look at a sun or a star, you know what that means. We just happen to have a crust around it. But underneath it, our crust on the earth is a very molten, red hot center, and we can draw on that heat. The second part I have to say is I've done a co-production technology, which means that to get to geothermal in Alberta and even North America, we took a very practical first approach that involved us working with the oil and gas industry, who already plumbs the depths of reservoirs and gets closer to that earth heat than most other industries do. And then we added a worldwide geothermal industry that typically does these projects in what looks like a place where they have geysers or volcanoes, where it's just a little bit more visual that you can see that earth heat coming to surface. So I say what we've done with co-production is a hand-in-glove technique where we've joined those two industries and basically taken advantage of both by understanding that both know a little bit about both parts, but you can bring them together in a co-production technique that actually complements the way we did the first geothermal heat-to-power project in Canada. And so the last thing I talk about, and it's very important, is innovation at the margins. And so one of the things that people think that innovation is these moonshots where you discover, you know, something that's never, ever been done before. But there's also this whole other segment of innovation, which means that you do exactly what I did, take what you know and improve it at the margin. And I liken it to Olympic records. And I have a little bit of a penchant for that because I'm a sports person. So if you think about world records and Olympic records, they fall in the milliseconds, but it's people at the top of their game striving for that next better step. And it's not a 1 minute win, it's a 0.01 second win. And that's kind of what this is. It's innovation at the margins. Don't be shy to know, to use what you know and get a little bit better at the periphery.
Perfect. Well, here at ERA, we do love that approach, taking the best practices from around the world and adding on them a little bit and getting them just to that one step farther in terms of the innovation and the benefits. So that's a great introduction to the technology. I really appreciate that. I think you've touched on a number of topics that we want to unpack throughout our conversation today. So I'll take the next couple of questions just to dig into a few of those points and get you to elaborate on them a little bit. So first and foremost, and you mentioned this right off the top, I think people are really familiar with geothermal energy as being, you know, in Iceland where you drill, you know, not very far down and you hit that magma that you talked about right away. In Alberta, we know that the heat resource is quite a bit farther down and like you say, more difficult to access. So why do you see geothermal technology as being an exciting opportunity for Alberta? And you talked about this already, but maybe just a little bit more detail. What do you see as being the novel component or the secret sauce of your approach to your innovation in this space?
Great question, Chris. And it really is. I'm going to talk about that innovation at the margin. So I've spent a career watching what oil and gas does really well. I happened to work for a big oil company quite a number of years ago that was already putting a price on carbon, even before the market was. So you realize that the world wants to go to cleaner energy. And so then you look around, and this is just how I innovate, and I've done my whole life this way. You look at what you know and where that little gap is. So how do we get to commercial by exploiting the gap and, you know, lowering technology risk, which also lowers your commercial risk? But how do you do what I would term this co-production technique? So for me, because I have a background in oil and gas, how do we capitalize on what we know? And even, to be honest, our world-class regulatory framework. How do you operate within what is there to do what you want to do? So do what is doable. So in, you know, what is Futura doing that's novel in this space, this co-production and heat upgrade? So in geothermal, the two things that people get most freaked out about are things that we kind of do as table stakes here. So we know how to drill. We know how to do resource production. That's something we do every day, all day. And there's like hundreds of thousands of people that know how to do it. So we've got great engineers. We've got great service companies. We've got incredible data in our assets. We've got all the requisite things to start geothermal from a place more advanced than typical geothermal. So if you're doing geothermal in Iceland, you're sticking a straw in the ground, really, like in a very large landscape, and hoping that you hit what you think you're going to hit. Well, what do we have in Alberta? We've been collecting data on the holes that we've drilled since the beginning of time. If you think about it, our industry has always been really good about collecting data and not even understanding what we were going to do with it. So in geothermal, security of supply is everything. So when I went to do this project, I had already started a company that we were looking at geothermal. We did a little heat project in Hinton. But what I really found out is the thing that you start with is the very best reservoir you can find. So when Razor Energy invited me to come in as the VP of New Ventures, I said to them, I think you really do have probably one of the best geothermal reservoirs in the province because it's sitting on a heat anomaly. But what can we do with existing assets to repurpose them to lower our capital costs so that this first one isn't such a step out on capital and technical risk? So what we really did was co-production and heat upgrades. So we lowered the risk on this one by knowing with this particular asset, you could put your hand on a pipeline in the field on the very first day we arrived and say, oh my goodness, that's hot, hot water. Can we harvest it right there and avoid that drilling risk, avoid that production risk? Understanding the hydrogeological loop was already there, so we had water circulating through the reservoir and back up to surface. How do we go and repurpose those existing assets so we've got the security of supply, no new drilling risk? We have two revenue sources, so this field has a traditional oil and gas revenue, but now it's going to have a green energy source. Isn't that a cool thing? And how do we plumb that data so that we can teach our investing community that we have lowered the risk because our data is from the 1960s. So we kind of can say that, hey, that well's been that hot for it. Here we measured it in 1972, here we measured it in 2010, it's the same. So you got that comfort zone. But and then again, going back to those regulatory frameworks, We already operate this system within regulatory frameworks that are really, really high standards. So my geothermal wasn't a big step out in regulatory because there really wasn't a geothermal pathway when we started. We had kind of helped everybody along the way and they were working on it anyway, but there was a real synergy there to use a demonstration project to improve the regulatory outlook as well. So that's kind of the approach we took.
Wonderful. And again, you've touched on so many really, really exciting aspects of the project. So I'll try to dig into a few of those as we go along. Maybe just for the benefit of our listeners, can you just walk us through what you mean when you talk about heat upgrades? I think that might be a new term for some folks.
Yeah, so that will go back to the difference between, say, Iceland and geysers and the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin, which typically your heat's going to run between 80 degrees Celsius because we go quite deep. Like our wells are 2.4 kilometers down. So you're really quite deep. You're getting into that mantle quite deep. But you don't typically find what you would see in the Ring of Fire, which is 200, 300 degrees C, and you use a different technology. So we have what was called low enthalpy deep geothermal. So you know that you're going to get somewhere on the low enthalpy side, and you're going to have to use what is called a binary organic Rankine cycle system. Those typically, if you're going to take them off the shelf, and there's everybody doing it, they start at about 120 degrees C, and they go all the way to whatever high temperature. You just use a kind of a different methodology to produce heat to power. So we knew that if we went to a wellhead in our field, we could probably get between 105 and 110 degrees C because we could walk around to wellheads, we could put our heat gun there, we could see it. But we would have lower flow and it'd be a single well. So if we wanted to do what we call a significant first step into geothermal heat to power, because we were aiming at 4 to 6 megawatts of power just to make it economic because it's economies of scale. You go small, you're just going to have a really hard time getting someone to invest in you. Go a little bit bigger and spread your megawatts over a bigger connection cost. Like your connection costs to do the grid connector are pretty significant. So these little guys have a really hard time getting started because they're just, the economies of scales just aren't there. So we, right from the get-go, we said, okay, we've got what we call a low enthalpy resource. We want to go grid connected. So we're going to have to figure out how to scale this. So can I get 4 to 6 megawatts of green so it's substantial? And what would I do to not only get to a higher output at this particular location, but also to upgrade that heat so I can use typical geothermal generation technology so I don't have to go invent something new to get after what a typical resource looks like in Western Canada. So if the inlet temperature is 120, and when I looked at the field, which is 6 miles by 6 miles, but I went to the central processing battery, which can see somewhere between 85 and 90 degrees, well, what would I do with that 90-degree water, harvest all that heat, but then upgrade it so that it can hit what is a typical ORC inlet temperature, which is 120? Well, I could kill two birds with one stone. I could put in natural gas generation, which is still what we do in this province. But I can clean it up and make it greener than by adding this 5 megawatts, call it on average or at peak, to whatever we do in the natural gas side. So way better than just natural gas unmitigated. So we added a 15 megawatt turbine, again, for economies of scale. We took all the heat off the back end of it to make it greener too, but it also allowed me to upgrade the heat. So it's kind of a two-part process. So I've got geothermal heat that comes in at 90, and then I use that duct heat to get it to 120, and then I feed it into an off-the-shelf ORC. So again, I'm sort of practical. I'm a Saskatchewan farm kid. How do you do, again, innovation at the margins? What do I have and what can I do right here to make sure that not only am I lowering the technology risk, but I'm getting to a commercial outcome so that the capital markets will invest in the second one I do? So that was just the approach we took.
Yeah, that's so exciting. So you're really taking a natural gas turbine, which people are very familiar with. You're taking, you know, the thermal energy coming up from the well, which, you know, everyone knows that like you say, you can go and put your hand on the pipe and it's quite warm. But it's not at that temperature that we're used to generating power from geothermal resources at. And so by combining the two, you can get that temperature up to where it's needed, that the energy can actually be extracted in an efficient way. And so, yeah, as a mechanical engineer and, you know, sort of dream about thermodynamic cycles in my sleep sometimes, gets me really excited hearing what you folks have managed to achieve over there. So thanks for that great explanation.
You know, and it's funny, Chris, I'm going to just build on that a little bit because one of the things you just said actually is close to my heart. So my training is in mechanical engineering, but really early on, I knew that I was a commercial girl. So you have to take your technical brain and your commercial brain and put them together. And it's really important because often we have a lot of engineers doing exciting innovation, but they forget that it actually has to be commercial, that you got to sell it to capital markets. And if you're going to make it global, it has to make money. So you really got to, there's a tension there. So you had to be practical about your approach. So that was the other underpin to it, is that we really knew we needed a commercial win for this first one.
Wonderful. I'll just ask you to unpack a little bit more another really exciting point you mentioned, which is how well this project, you know, synergizes with Alberta's existing expertise and our long history in the oil and gas space. So I think the issue of, you know, the number of active but also inactive wells across the province is certainly top of mind. And so earlier you mentioned, you know, the fact that we have this huge population of wells and long, long drilling history in the province actually gives us this wealth of data to rely on to understand where those heat resources might be. So can you maybe just speak in a little bit more detail about the extent to which existing wells of varying ages and conditions can potentially be repurposed for geothermal, whether that's for co-production or even just for data, and maybe just take us through how that looks from your side as a project developer?
Oh, so you hit this thing bang on. So we have, 700,000 holes in the ground in this province? But more than that, we have data. We have incredible engineers and operators and service companies. Everybody knows how to do resource production. And I'll call it resource for a particular reason. You take a liquid from way deep in the rock and you get it to surface and you separate it and use it accordingly. The whole world doesn't do this. We forget that we're special that way. Geothermal looks exactly like oil and gas. You're just extracting something different. So there's heat in that hot rock, but how does it get to surface? Well, it gets there probably with produced water, sometimes in gas, but not as efficient. So you kind of are looking for that water thing that we do. I mean, that's table stakes for us. We know how to handle produced fluids, and we're exceptionally good at it. So we've got the people that know how to do it. We've got the kind of technology in the field that knows how to handle it. But we have to really be proud of what we could do. So then there's three types of wells, or three types of things you can do with wells. First and foremost, there's a great number of those 700 wells that can be just straight for heat. So if you have a proximal use of it, so say you have a town or a greenhouse or in an industry or a community, if your wells are close to that and you don't have to go very deep to get enough heat to do a heat-to-heat project. So that's super exciting. And again, out of what we've proven, that you can actually do geothermal heat or heat to power, our economic model would show you that both would do about the same kind of technique that we did. So if you can do heat and use it locally, that's going to be awesome. And out of those 700,000, a good solid tranche of those will be practical for heat to heat projects. The second thing is heat to power. So the way that we did it, now there are thousands of wells that you can use, but you have to be, these are long-term 40-year projects, so we can also understand that we are really good at putting casing in there that can handle thermal heat for a really long time. We're really good at knowing about when casings degrade and all that kind of stuff. So heat to power, you're going to need a lot longer timeline, and you're going to need a more specialized hole because, again, you got to meet that lower threshold of 80 to 90 degrees of bottom hole temperature. But again, you said it, in those wells, if you don't have good casing, but you got the data, you can drill right beside it and know exactly what you're going to get. So there's value there, right? Like, that's a very, very good thing. But there are places in Alberta where you can do exactly what I did, and that is our plan, to do more projects like this with this co-production technique where you can go in situ in an oil and gas facility where that heat is already at surface and do exactly what I did. We have had a reach out from a place in the U.S. that's very interested because I think we're the first actually in North America to do what we did. There are quite a bit of fields that look like ours in the U.S., and that's our plan, is to go into those. But then there's this third thing that I'm working on right now, and it's sort of wellhead IP. So we learned a lot in what we did, and I've been chasing the wellhead IP for 6 years. Actually, the global community is chasing it pretty hard. I believe Alberta will win that race as well because we know so much about reservoir and how to get at reservoir, and we had to credit ourselves with what we know. And so say we can get to a lower enthalpy with a different type of wellhead approach. Well, we open the global landscape to heat to heat and heat to power at a wellhead. And that gets very exciting because think about 700,000 wells where you can aggregate them in a field and do a power output from that field, not just here, but everywhere. And it goes to the liability. So if someone took the time to drill a $3 million, $4 million, $10 million well, and they've gotten the hydrocarbons out of it. What happens at the end of even half of those while there's a green energy outcome? Wouldn't that be exciting? So there's that future there too. And I mean, that's the one that makes my socks roll up and down, to use a Saskatchewan expression.
No, that is tremendously exciting. And I think really speaks to the, you know, the future paths that this technology can take, which we're certainly very excited about at ERA as well. Maybe I'll just get you to hone in on that piece a little bit more in terms of the potential for wide adoption of the technology and where you see the biggest market opportunities for it in the near future.
So I think one of the things Alberta just generally maybe doesn't do as well as it should is just crow about what we know. So I think there's three things we can do. So now that I've done co-production, I would like to go right into conventional, which involves drilling, just to prove that it can be done. That those two particular things, like I said, they'll apply to any oil and gas jurisdiction, because oil and gas is becoming deeper, longer, and probably hotter in a lot more places, because resources are getting harder to find. So we're growing into the place where we should live anyway, because those easy oil resources are not easy anymore. So deep horizontals have more potential. SAGD actually looks like geothermal if you look like it, because they put heat down and you can recover it on the back end. That's one great idea that I know is there. So using your geothermal lens, I think what we know in Alberta, we were the first to really kill a horizontal. We do SAGD very well. We now are the first in geothermal. We got to look globally to just say we can do it here, but where else could we do it, and use the Alberta incredible people resource to scale. So those are the couple of things we could do. But then again, my pet project, it's not so pet anymore, but we're hoping to be starting something soon, is this wellhead thing. And then it's prolific, because there is a worldwide industry that absolutely needs an end-of-life answer, and no one's solved that. Right now, we just put cement down the hole and reclaim it to what it was. That's pretty awesome. But just think about, if you, again, go back to the drilling costs, which have only gotten higher, if you could capture that sunk cost of capital and do power generation or heat generation at the wellhead, because you're not having to drill, you can just repurpose to that new green outcome. I think that's the most exciting for me.
Yeah, that's incredibly exciting, and really happy to hear your passion on that, and really happy to hear that there is that significant market potential, you know, both within Alberta and then beyond. You know, part of what we look for in projects that we fund is that potential for export of the technology, of the solution, you know, once we've proven it here. So very, very exciting to hear.
Yeah, I would say, like, I'm sorry, Chris, I didn't mean to, but like, even if you look at what Alberta's developing, CCUS, hydrogen, like, we could be the birthplace of so much innovation. We just kind of have to get out of our own way on timelines, because I think one of the things that hurts is it just takes us a long time to get things going. And I must say, and I'm going to give myself a plug here, one of the things we did at the outset of our co-production was we wanted to go as fast as was safe and palatable. And, you know, I'd like to crow that we built a project in 4 years, and two of those was COVID. Can you imagine? I could have taken a year out of that if we wouldn't have got sideswiped by a global pandemic and, you know, an absolute gutting of the energy systems around the world. So there is an urgency that we also in Alberta have to understand, that somebody wants to solve this, let it be us.
Absolutely. And I do want to circle back on the COVID pandemic and the challenges that it brought for innovators. But first, I just want to, you know, capture one point that you mentioned and just maybe just give you one more opportunity to speak to it, because I think you speak to it so well. And that's really the connectivity between our existing oil and gas sector and the potential for, you know, this new geothermal industry in the province. And so it sounds like from some of what you said previously that there's plenty of opportunities for the expertise and our know-how and our skilled workers and our, you know, wonderful innovation ecosystem that have for decades been supporting the oil and gas sector, for all of that expertise and sort of backing to support an equally successful geothermal sector. Are there any other links between the two industries that that might not be apparent to first glance that you want to highlight for us?
Oh, God, it's attitude. My goodness. Alberta's just got such a great attitude. You just can't keep good people down. We just keep coming up swinging, right? And if you look at it in Alberta, so Alberta is leading renewables, right? Because why? Because we have a deregulated market, and if you have a good idea and you can get it financed, you can go build it. That's awesome. We kind of take that tact. We like innovation, and we've got this, and I'm going to speak only to my background. You know, I'm a farm kid from Saskatchewan. We didn't have a lot of anything. And so what's the expression? What's the motherhood of all invention? Necessity is the motherhood of all invention, because you don't have a lot of money to deal with. So you got to get bloody creative. You got to find like the baler twine and bubblegum solution to make things happen. But I don't know if I've met anyone here that doesn't kind of have that can-do attitude. So you can't really even put a price, like a price on that. Alberta just has such a go-get-it-done attitude, and you just feel that. You feel that with the regulators. You feel that with the ERA partnership. You feel that with Alberta Innovates. It's the village. It takes a village to rise up these projects, and everywhere you look, that support is there. If, again, I have to be good at articulating what I'm trying to do. I have to have done my homework. I can't come in half-baked. Nobody believes you if you haven't done your homework. But, when you get that wind in your sails, you just find all these great people supporting it and going it forward. And even my own team, you know, they're oil and gas people, but I had to remind them that they had the requisite skills and that I would mentor them in the gaps, like, because I've done this for quite a while. But, you know, just bring your good attitude and effort. We'll get it done. And it's a funny thing, because it's a little bit about our resilience and tenacity. So I've got a process engineer. He said to me one day, and he goes, "I'm glad it's you." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He goes, "Well, everybody else would have quit by now." And I laughed. And I said, "Did you just call me stupid?" And he said, no, I mean it the right way. But it is a little bit of that grittiness that we have that you have to harness when you innovate. Because, and I've always thought about this, the road to success and failure look exactly the same. They just have a different outcome. Success just means you keep making good decisions and you don't give up even when it gets hard. Because often, if you give up one step before the final, you don't know that you would have succeeded. You just have to sort of stay with it until you really, like, and sometimes you do have to change your path a little bit because you just are wrong. And I'm okay with that. But that's part of being an innovator. And I think there's a humbleness in that too. And I see that all over Alberta is, I don't need to know everything, but I'm going to gather up a group that between all of us, we're going to figure it out.
Great. And yeah, we'll go down that path in a couple of questions time. Before we get there, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't take a brief detour through the hard numbers that we love so much. And so maybe if you can just speak briefly to the scale of the greenhouse gas emissions reductions that you expect from the technology, as well as the energy cost savings that your solution can potentially deliver.
Yeah, so I'll also give you a little bit of hint. We spent $49 million on the project, which was a little more than we wanted to spend. But again, when the supply chain tightening up and COVID hitting, it stands to reason that it was going to be slightly more than we expected, but still pretty proud of it. Built in 4 years. Our output is 4 to 6 megawatts. Again, we're going to keep optimizing this plant because we actually installed a generation technology that will take 7 megawatts. We wanted to make sure that we had enough. So if our average energy output, which is 4.3 megawatts, the actual calculated number using ERA's calculation, which is called a MMV, and I'm not going to remember the acronym, but it's a template for how you calculate it, just to keep us all honest so that it's auditable, it says that our average annual emissions reductions would be just shy of 19,000 tons of CO2 per annum. We've calculated this 20-year plant life, which we know can be stretched to 30 or 40, but again, we try to be conservative. So over the life of the plant, we will do 398,000 tons of CO2 reduction. So let's call it 400,000 tons of CO2 reduction. That's a substantial CO2 reduction from a what is a first project. So we're really, really proud of that. And energy savings, I think, honestly, we're competitive in this market. And that's what was my goal, too, to be agnostic to what the politicians say is the price on carbon and all that. We were just going to be better than what was happening in Alberta so that we knew we could compete on price. And we've been able to do that. So we are commercially successful. And I don't like to publish our rates of return, but I can tell you from the model that we submitted to all the funders that we have exceeded that. So we have exceeded Futura's benchmark threshold rate. And I think that's important because you have to have credibility with your outside funders that not only were you good in your modeling, but that you actually can prove that you met or exceeded. Now, there are historically high power prices, which is a little tough on consumers, but it has helped us in this first year. It does for a startup, but we do welcome that.
Wonderful. And of course, you know, the ultimate solution to high power prices is bringing new clean sources of power on the grid that are economically competitive. So you're certainly a big part of that. So in addition to the greenhouse gas benefits, can I get you to briefly take us through the potential societal and health benefits for Canadians and for Albertans from geothermal technologies?
Sure. There's a lot, actually. So what I like about geothermal, just generally, if you look around the world, so everybody is looking for cleaner sources of energy. electricity demand is going to grow, and we know that. The thing that we're struggling with is intermittent resources. So wind and solar have their place for sure, but they have to be backstopped by a baseload technology. Right now, in many parts of the world, that's either natural gas or coal. We'd really like to get off coal and at least have natural gas be natural gas cogen so that it's got some heat recovery and it's greener then. But the problem with wind and solar is battery technology hasn't kept pace with the installation of it. So where I see the societal benefits of geothermal, very, very important, is what I call firm renewable. So geothermal is 24/7 baseload dispatchable. It can come into a system. It keeps the grid very, very stable because it's always available, but it doesn't have these ups and downs and volatility that come with intermittent resources. So that's a societal benefit because people need affordable, but more importantly, reliable energy. So baseload resource on the firm renewable side is a hugely important societal benefit. The other thing is really small footprint. Like you can make this, our little site is, 400 meters by 400 meters. Pretty impressive that you can make all that energy out of a site that you can walk around, right? Like that people don't think about as much either. So you have less impact on wildlife. You have less impact on just, you know, taking arable land or trees and knocking them down to put an energy footprint there. So very big benefit there. And of course, the societal benefit of cleaning up the air is just that. We have no impact on water because it's a closed loop system. We're just bringing up reservoir water and putting it back down. So we don't use any fresh water. We did all our wildlife studies, and in the place that we're in, it, because we're remote, we didn't have any impact to wildlife. So these things really matter to us, because I do understand that we measure GHG, but we do have to have a holistic approach at how we actually hit the environment. So no new footprint, right? Brownfield site, small footprint over time, that would really matter. Baseload dispatchable, and then no impact to wildlife. Those were all things that we were very, very proud of.
Yeah, I'll say in particular, I think the value of clean, firm generation resources on the grid is extremely important. There's been, you know, numerous studies on the fact of we look to be able to get a large fraction of our energy in total from wind and solar and other variable renewables. But you do need to mix in a little bit of that firm and dispatchable generation to really make the cost of the overall transition feasible. So I'm really happy to hear you touch on that point. And obviously, I'd say geothermal is one of those sweet spot technologies that does fall into that category that could really be, you know, a key enabler of that overall clean grid that we do want to get to.
Yeah, you know, okay. I'm going to say one more thing. So when I wanted to be an adult in the clean energy world, and I looked around and I said, like, geothermal really floats my boat. I would have done SMRs, but they weren't mature enough, and people aren't really happy about having them in their backyard. I do think they have a place, but you could put geothermal in a community, and it would be really quite benign as compared to a lot of other things. And that mattered to me. So I picked geothermal coming out of big oil and said, you know, if I want to be in a space where I can make a difference, geothermal really worked for me.
If there's one thing people here are comfortable having in their backyard, it appears to be oil wells. So if those become geothermal wells instead, they'll probably look more or less the same on top, right? So,
and you can drive around a field anywhere in Alberta and Saskatchewan and see this small footprint, but this doesn't really look much different than that. And we're really, really good at it. And people are comfortable beside it because they know we're really good at it. So it translates really well.
Carbon Copy is brought to you by Emissions Reduction Alberta. ERA takes action on climate change and supports economic growth by investing in clean technology solutions that reduce greenhouse gas emissions, lower costs, attract investment, and create jobs here in Alberta. These investments help innovators develop and demonstrate technology that can lower emissions at home and be exported all over the world. That's why we've committed almost $800 million to 220 projects, worth a total of $6.5 billion. To learn more, visit eralberta.ca.
Okay, well, you know, we've talked about all of the exciting and innovative and sort of blue sky, you know, all the good news. But I think it's always worthwhile in these conversations to go through, you know, what challenges you faced and what some of the solutions were along your path to success. As you mentioned, the pathway to success and the pathway to failure can often look quite similar until you get to the final outcome. And so sticking the course and working through it with partners and with resources in the ecosystem are extremely important. So you already touched a little bit on the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. Obviously, ERA came in on this project at a favorable time in that regard. We came in before the pandemic. We were able to stick with the project, and obviously you folks stuck with the project as well through all of the upheaval in the markets and supply chains. Can you maybe tell us a little bit more about your organization's experience navigating the pandemic and working with ERA through these various challenges?
Well, I can kind of say it very simply. Without ERA, we would have had to stop. Like, we just would have. So we are a junior oil and gas company, or that's where I used to work, and I'll talk about the corporate change that we've had. But you got to think about this. You know, we're 5,000 barrels a day. We're keeping, you know, we're making money for our shareholders. We're a publicly traded company. And you put on this what is considered an R&D project because it hasn't been done before. So it has that R&D flavor to it. Bigger companies tend to have bigger resources to do experimental kinds of things. So I've said right from the beginning that without Alberta Innovates and ERA, we probably couldn't have got it across the line. And there's this thing called first movers, and government support of first movers innovation is incredibly important because you're partnering early. So Alberta Innovates came in, and I know they're a partner agency to ERA, so I'll talk about the first and then go back to ERA. So Alberta Innovates came in very early, partnered with Enerkem because they had a green energy fund, and they just said, hey, you know, we know you need a little bit of money to get you started. I did a white paper. They all agreed conceptually that it could run. But that early money, particularly Alberta's Innovate support, how they came in on the front end, allowed us to do enough engineering to really get to where we'd be what is called TRL level 7, so we could be commercial. And so we did a geochemistry pilot in the field to make sure our heat transfer model worked, to make sure that our geochemistry was well known, because those can be really, really difficult for geothermal. And we had early support from Alberta Innovates and Enercan on the federal level. But what ERA did, and you said it yourself, they came in on that commercial part. So everybody believes we can build the project, but how do we build the project when the capital markets just don't know geothermal co-production? So ERA stepped in before COVID hit and said, hey, we like that you're going to take your technology commercial, and it's going to be something that you could do over, and it will have a commercial outcome, but you could, you know, do global scaling. And that's kind of where ERA sits, is in that TRL 7 to 9, and we could prove that our project was in that space, so it came in with that later funding. But then COVID hit, and we came to ERA and said, okay, now what do we do? Oil prices are underwater. We have no idea what the solve is. We don't know how far this pandemic is going to reach. You know, we're going to be honest with you to say we have to slow down or stop. And ERA said, well, we'll partner with you and we'll keep you going. But we're going to need that you meet another milestone on the end of this thing where you can prove to us that you did your work and you're not, that you're going to finish. And so ERA, in their wisdom, embedded a milestone that said, okay, now are you going to finish? You got to go get external financing. You got to prove to us that you can be commercial. And so ERA stuck with us through the depths of COVID, and then we did get external financing, and then we did finish. But the other thing that ERA does exceptionally well is the project managers and even the folks there really do understand what commercialization means. So there's actually a relationship where you go back and forth and you sort of problem solve together. So you aren't just a check writing facility, you're actually a project partner. And it felt like that, where we had a relationship where we could ask questions and draw on some of the things you knew to keep going. And I think you're far more active than the other two agents. Well, Alberta Innovates is pretty active too, but when they hand it over to you, that partnership really mattered to me, because I do believe in a fully transparent partnership. I think you win when you run that way, and I think ERA was outstanding at that. So I think ERA really has a place in this province in developing new technologies and assisting first movers with the hard things. And so then I'm going to jump back into regulatory. When there's no regulatory support, you know it's going to take you a little longer and you're going to have to bust through some barriers. So again, that's where government support is needed, because again, smaller companies won't take on that regulatory risk when you can't see a pathway. But because I had a partnership with ERA, I felt comfortable that we could take that on quite more straightforwardly and understand that if there was impact, we had a little bit of backstop to making our way through that. And I'm proud to say that a Geothermal Resource Act has been published during our tenure, and we were a pretty strong voice in that process. So that was a good thing. And that's also a good investment of government money to make sure that policy is being developed alongside the project.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'll say it's not uncommon at all that many of our projects end up becoming, you know, motivators for regulatory change, or at least informing regulatory change. You know, that's part of the landscape when it comes to investing in first of kind. So very, very good, important to touch on that point. Maybe I'll just get you to unpack in a little bit more detail what that sort of regulatory and permitting space looks like, where those hurdles might still be, and what really the new regulatory developments mean for technologies like this one.
Yeah, so it's complicated, right? Regulatory always is, but we have this framework around resource production. So I knew that I can continue to do what we do. So really what we already do is there's a hydrogeologic loop that I talked about. So the junior oil and gas company injects water down, sweeps the reservoir, brings water up, separates the hot water, takes the oil, and then delivers the hot water to us at surface. We don't even take custody of it. We just run it through a closed loop system, it's called, where we run it past a working fluid. We hive off all the heat. We take the heat into our project, and that water stays on the oil and gas side. So for us, the regulatory was pretty simple. That heat production is regulated by the Alberta Energy Regulator, or the AER. So that was super transparent. What wasn't there was, okay, how do you put a power project in the middle of an oil and gas facility? So they had to figure that out. What do you call it? Is it an oil and gas facility with a sublease? Is it a geothermal facility? A geothermal facility is actually more like an oil and gas facility than a power facility. How do you do liability and closure and remediation? Well, the interesting part is power has a closure and remediation outlook. Oil and gas has a closure and remediation outlook. They both roll up to the same act. So what we just said to the regulators was like, how about we just take the higher bar, which is oil and gas, because there's a real framework around how you address liability. Let us just do closure and remediation under that act. I still think there's a little work to do there because there's going to be pure geothermal that doesn't exactly know how to do that. So there's still, I'm going to say that's, there is policy around it, but the devil's in the details. And we're talking about that. I've got a meeting actually this week to talk a little bit more about that. But it is through demonstration projects where you find out where you've got gaps. So the AER and the AUC and all those folks said, keep moving, keep developing, we'll find a way for you to operate. But behind it, we're going to develop policy that allows for what you've done, but even takes a broader look at it to say, okay, if we didn't do co-production and we did pure geothermal, how would that look vis-a-vis what you did? And so they did put a framework around it. I still think there's, just saying, you don't get it 100% right the first time, but there's enough meat on the bone with this new Geothermal Resource Act that people can get started and have some certainty around continuing. And like I said, I'm meeting with them again tomorrow because I have some ideas and I'm really kind of excited about this, about how we can keep moving and sort of win the day building on the framework that we have and being very creative about how you keep moving.
Very, very exciting. Well, I think folks that have listened to many of our Carbon Copy episodes know that we at ERA love the concept of lessons learned. It's part of going through these first-of-kind projects. You learn by doing, and you encounter things that you maybe never thought of at the outset, and that helps move technology forward. So maybe, Lisa, I'll just get you to briefly take us through what some of the top lessons learned from this project were, and really what came to light in the process of executing the project and overcoming those challenges that we've talked about.
Well, one of the biggest lessons learned is the strength of contracts, because nobody puts a global pandemic into the contracts, you're right. But you always have to, like, contracts are great because you do power, or these big power projects take a couple years to build. You start contracting at the beginning, at the end, you go, man, I would have done that different had I known what we were going to go through in the middle of it. But, you know, I actually would put somebody legal on my team right from the get-go, because contracting is really important and just making sure that everybody's on the same page about what good outcomes look like. So we probably learned a bit of a lesson there, but also having strategic partnerships. And we had some really good ones, and we had a couple, honestly, I'm going to be honest, not great ones. Like, just in innovation, you really need that mindset to be joined up. And it's not just your internal team, it's also the external team. Like, you really have to focus on making sure that everybody knows what a win looks like and that we're all operating under the same. So that was one of the learnings. Two was, and I knew this, geochemistry is really, really hard. Those deep earth brines are pretty caustic. And so, you know, we thought we had a handle on that. We're still doing some what I'll call optimizing work. You know, once you start running, you see, like, you can't even surmise what you're going to be up against until you start running for a while and you see what the effects of things that you only could model. So we did learn that geochemistry is really something to think long and hard about, and metallurgy. So that's a really big one. The other thing is that I would say just the learnings, and this is a big one. So capital markets. I did engineering because I love being creative. But then I really got commercial because money is the most creative thing that you'll do. And so I was thinking about ESG in 2018 before the market was really thinking about it. What I didn't understand was that when ESG became a really big thing, that the capital markets would hive themselves into two camps. So oil and gas is well understood, had a very strong capital market here. It kind of really got soft in 2018, 2019, because the world was talking about the end of fossil fuels and all that. So that market got a little bit tougher to deal with. But then on the other side of it was these gigantic green funds that couldn't place money fast enough. The interesting part was when you talked about what is transition energy, it didn't mean take an oil and gas facility and make it slightly greener. It meant don't do oil and gas and only do green. So what I, when we went to capital partners, they're like, ooh, oil and gas. Yeah, no, we don't do that. We just do pure green. So we had a foot in both camps. And so we didn't really know where we lived. And we actually had to go through a lot to find the capital partner that understood both and understood that the practicality of physics and economics requires us to do this innovation at the margins. And it's a good thing. And I will say, since the war in Ukraine and, you know, people getting far more conversant on energy and energy security, I think there's a whole funding mechanism that's emerging now that has that transition energy thought. And it's going to be easier in the future to go to capital markets with these sort of blended ideas where they can see that in 20 years, we're going to be net zero or sooner. But that this, like, you know, Alberta's going to be net zero, 2050, 2035, somewhere in between, that it's okay to support technologies because the oil and gas industry has spent more than any other industry in Canada developing clean technologies. So you're going to have to be able to understand that that's where new energy forms are going to come from, and it's okay. So that conversation's gotten better. But I will say at the beginning, I was like, oh man, you know, everybody talks about transition, but who's funding it? That was a learning.
So I think building on that, we're going to move into a bit of a forward-looking section of today's episode, really looking at where this technology and where geothermal as a whole can go out into the future. So maybe I'll just get you to start there and take us through what you think Alberta and Canada's geothermal potential look like going forward. And also, if you feel comfortable, what role you see Futura playing in uncovering this largely untapped resource.
Yeah, so I'm going to repeat that there is potential. So there's a couple of things that Futura wants to do, and I'll just move into what we could do globally, because Futura became a standalone entity in June. We have a top-tier capital partner in the Alberta Investment Management Company. They bought our equity. So that's AIMCo. It's a solid top-tier partner. So we've got now the backstop of the capital partner that we thought we needed. Razor is still involved. So our first step is to look at the Razor match sheet. So they're our minor equity partner. We have some of the best geothermal reservoirs in Western Canada, full stop. So we want to do more projects. So what we want to do now, so we took that sort of no-risk co-production view. We want to add more of a pure play geothermal to show that you can drill and still make money and add to what we already have. And like I said, this particular ORC that we bought, the organic Rankine cycle generation equipment, has some headroom. So we'd like to fill it up. We've paid for the grid connect. We've got all the infrastructure there. I just need more and hotter water to fill this thing up. So that's part of it. But then we have this 6 mile by 6 mile field where we know the reservoir is just absolutely perfect for what we want to do. What's the next project in this reservoir? Because we think the thermal potential of this reservoir is 20 megawatts geothermal. That'd be very, very cool. But also in that play in this reservoir, because we don't have heat risk and we don't have a lot of the risk, we've taken them all out, a little test on the IP that we think that would make us a global player. So we got the top tier capital partner. We've got a top tier asset. Now we get to play with it and really figure out how to grow this thing and lead. So why would Futura be a leader? Well, we've got the credibility of the first build. We've shown it can be done. We've shown it can be done quickly. We can show that it was done pretty well on budget, save for the bust that COVID and supply chain things did. We're still pretty proud of being as close to budget as we were. So we have credibility in the space to do more. And we get reach outs. Oh my gosh, every week somebody comes to me. Can you help me do this? Can you help me do that? So we want to be leaders in this space. We also want to go into the US because their oil and gas fields look exactly like ours and their permitting is very familiar. So do a North American strategy. And so Futura, grow them at home, take them at least to North America. And then if I find all the right people, then there's a global strategy there. But it really is more co-production, conventional geothermal to show that it can stand alone, and then this IP. And side by that, I've actually got, and developing a partnership here on heat to heat. Like I said, that's prolific. It's not hard. It's technically quite a bit simpler, but it's the proximal load. So you can only do it where somebody can use it where it's right there. And they do have a couple of plays there, but it actually needs us to do the IP well because they're, to be honest, I want to sink a well in a residential area and just show that you can do it. And, you know, we got a housing crisis. We also have in this province a utility price crisis. It's something that people are thinking about. We could solve that if we do the right thing on the IP side. Because you could, honestly, you could put these things where you need them to be. And if you even look at the European example, they do geothermal everywhere where they geothermally heat districts because they just have to. That's, you know, they need that baseload heat supply. They don't necessarily have access to natural gas like we do. So if you look across Europe and even in the U.S., there's places doing it. Heat to heat's quite smart. So Futura wants to own all that, but I would say there's a lot more players in the heat side of the business. We really, really want to lead the heat to power business and be prolific in Alberta, Western Canada, and then the U.S. And that is all within a five-year time frame in my mind.
That's so exciting. And I think definitely on our side, we're very excited about geothermal heat to power, but also, as you mentioned, the heat and direct geothermal applications are very, very exciting. So I'm really looking forward to some more developments in that area going forward. Maybe if you can just take us through what you see as the biggest benefit or biggest competitive advantage that you have. Possibly it's just being a first mover in the space, but I'm open to being corrected on that front. That will help you to deliver on that amazing potential that you've just talked about.
So number one is our first mover credibility. Number two is we have data. I can show you what operating data looks like. I don't have pristine data yet, but I will in the next 6 months. Capital markets love data. I love data. I'm a numbers junkie. You can prove that this is the model. This is how you make money. Here's what we would change on the next project. It's this little bit of risk, but here's what the earning looks like. You know, over time, that just gets better and better. So credibility of first mover is the fact that you got it built, you got it done in 4 years. So they know that you're that resilient kind of mindset on the innovation piece. Right behind it is your data set. Again, I talked about data, plumbing the data. Number three is I'm not shy to use the expertise that we know in this province. I'm extremely prolific in reaching out to folks that I know that are good at particular things. We have all of it. We just have to tap it. And I think I've got enough of a network and connections and even an understanding of resource production to do that. But the last thing is I have a voice. It matters actually. I have a voice in helping people understand how complex energy systems are and how we can practically go forward to get to our net zero 50 targets. Physics overrides everything. So pace and physics and price and policy are all intertwined. And I actually spend, when I'm doing this podcast now, every time someone asks me to talk, I talk. Why? Because it's great to have ideologies and targets, but you also need a translator in the mix. So I've got a mechanical engineering background, but I also took journalism. And I think there's a need for more of us to talk about what we do and how we do it so that the rest of the country comes along on the journey. Because I don't believe that anybody's fighting us. I don't believe that Canada doesn't want the same thing. I think we all want the same thing. We need a middle ground where people talk about this energy literacy thing so that we can ask for what we really want. Because there's a couple of camps now where there's an ideology-driven conversation and then an energy, like practical people, like we're in it and this is how hard it is. But joining those two conversations, because I believe that most Canadians are more alike than we think. So I really figure that one of the advantages Futura has is I have a voice and I'm using it and I hope to keep using it to make sure that these things keep moving because you got to talk about what innovation looks like.
So I guess, Lisa, we've talked a lot about this huge potential that there is for this technology and for your company in particular. What does that actually look like in terms of operationalizing the next steps for Futura and what you're hoping to do after closing out this ERA project?
Well, we have several projects in development. Like I said, we'd like to hit the ground running this fall or early next year with the second and third project, and they're sort of intertwined. So drilling would be part of it, but just, again, to prove to the market the credibility that you can add drilling to these projects because you know the reservoirs, so you're not taking a big step out. fill up the project we have. But this IP one, and there's a race on IP, and we've got to make sure that we've got patent protections on it. But that race, we can't drag our feet on. So I'm putting some money at risk internally to do it, and we're just going to go. I've got this bias. We have a plan, but talk is cheap. You just got to go get it done. And I'm a doer. Do what is doable. Keep moving. If you're standing still, you're probably losing. You got to keep moving. Now, my dad used to have this expression because I grew up in a hockey family. He'd say, you know, if they open the gate, he'd be downtown. Like, don't skate off the end of the ice and have no direction, that all you're about is speed. That's not what I do. But don't let great be the enemy of good. We keep making good decisions and keep moving the ball down the ice. We've got a 5-year plan. We've got all the requisite parts to keep moving. So we just have to make sure that Alberta wins this one. And Canada, to be honest. And then tell the story. Like keep telling the story. Like, make sure that the general population in Canada supports what we do here. And ERA is certainly leading all that.
Well, one last question for you. And I think just to end on a note of talking about that continued momentum towards the future. And I just wanted your thoughts, Lisa, as, you know, one of the leaders in Alberta's energy transition. How have you seen this shift in our energy system evolve since you started the project? And where do you see that trend line, you know, going in the future? And, I think you touched on it earlier, but I think it would be just great to end with a final word on that.
It's incredible to me how much things have changed in a very short time period, because really, generally speaking, changing energy systems would be like changing, you know, moving the Titanic, big, slow moves, just because it's expensive and there's a lot of infrastructure around it. So in 2018, I always joke with folks that I wrote this white paper under my desk. You know, we could do geothermal here, but the company was so busy just making, you know, a junior oil and gas company run, I kind of had to protect what I thought was a really good idea. So in 2018, there wasn't really the price on carbon that would make it go. We were doing economics on $40 to $60 power. Like, it really was going to be tough to do it. 2019, we got funded from Alberta Innovates. We started the engineering. You're starting to hear ESG bubble up in conversation a lot more. Well, what is ESG and what does it mean and how do you define it? Well, we should, if you can do well and do better, why wouldn't we clean up our environment? I've got a bunch of kids, I can say it, 5. I want to leave them an industry that I'm proud of. Interestingly enough, I've got 3 kids that are already engineers, so there is a legacy bit for me. So I could go on being a traditional engineer. I could probably have a very good living, but I really, really had this burning desire to do better and do the innovation piece. So 2019, we get funded. We do enough engineering. The world started to talk about it. Well, like 2020, 2021, all you could hear on almost every business show was ESG targets and how do we get there. And then Ukraine hits. And then you start seeing some of those holes that get started if you go too fast. Because reliability matters. So I've coined a term inside my head, what good looks like to me. It is net zero poverty, net zero climate. Or environment is the better the word for me, because it, to me, environment takes in water, takes in air, it takes in wildlife. I think it's a broader conversation. But we have to balance the standard of living that we have come to be accustomed to. We have to understand that the rest of the world wants what we want. And there is a very good way to get there, but we got to work together because it's going to be really, really hard. And there's a lot of voices in this space, like Vaclav Smil is one that just talks about how complicated energy systems are to change. And it will take time for us to do this in a way where we don't make people poor, because we've gone so fast that we've made it expensive. So I think the way the ESG world is now sitting is that we all agree we're going to do better, but what's the right pace and policy to get us there so that we don't have unintended consequences of our good ideas? And so I think for me, from 2018, really nobody talking about it, to like the ideology leading it now to that practical place where I like to sit, well, how the heck do we just get it done so that we're doing better every day, but we're keeping citizens where they can afford to live where we are? And so it's that really nice tension that focuses on price and reliability as well.
Well, what a great place to end. Thank you so much for being with us today, Lisa. I think your answers are certainly inspiring to me, and I was already familiar with the project, so I'm sure our listeners are going to be just blown away by everything you've been able to share and everything you and your team have accomplished with with this project. So very, very exciting and very proud to have it part of the ERA portfolio. So thanks again for all of your time today. And I think that's where we'll end it.
Thank you very much, Chris. And I have to say, couldn't have done it without ERA. I'm going to give that last plug back to you because there's some friendships over there too, where it really was a partnership. And I do appreciate that outlook from ERA. So thank you for doing this today. Again, we have a voice, so let's use it. But the partnership was critical to our success.